Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Marianne Combs. This is NPR News. Now we go in-depth on the future of journalism. From his campaign to his election, to his first dealings with foreign leaders as president-elect, Donald Trump has created an unprecedented challenge for journalists. How do you cover the soon-to-be leader of the free world when that leader lies openly? How do you report on a president who has convinced his followers that the press is made up of dishonest villains? When the president-elect continually eschews the democratic process, should journalists remain dispassionate conveyors of facts and quotes, or is it time for something different? I'm joined this hour by Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media, which you can hear each week here on NPR. Welcome, Brooke. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for asking.
And we're also joined by Indira Somani, professor of media, journalism, and film at Howard University. Indira Somani, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
First off, to you, Brooke, what can we learn from the fact that the press and broadcast journalists so completely failed to predict Trump's win, to see the strength of Trump's popularity with voters?
Right. And you would want to emphasize the latter part of that, failed to see the strength of his popularity with voters. The thing is that there was that reporting. There were quite a few great pieces from the field that dug in great papers and magazines, New Yorker, New York Times, Washington Post, and so on, that really explained what was going on. The problem was, as Masha Gessen, the great Russian journalist, said, was a failure of the imagination. The reporting was out there. We, as an institution, just didn't take the right lesson from it. And you have to be important because you have to be very careful, because right now, the whole argument, the whole way forward for journalists is about framing the issue. And if you consider that Hillary Clinton's popular lead keeps growing, I think it's up to 2.7 million now, and they haven't finished California, then maybe calling him a winner and saying that the media overwhelmingly missed this idea is actually more of a Trumpian frame than the reality.
So asking the question, did journalists fail the electorate, is that still a valid question?
That's a very valid question. It's the contextual information that is at issue. And with all the people that we've spoken to so far, they said the way forward for journalists is in framing reality, offering a counter frame for reality and putting the fact checks into that counter frame, that is to say, counter to the counterfactual frame that is being offered, as you said, from the president-elect.
Looking back, you mentioned Masha Gessen, who's reported for years on Vladimir Putin and Russian politics. I believe it was in one article she suggested reporters should have been covering Trump as a man looking to lead not a democracy, but an autocracy. The notion, if we had framed the coverage in that sense, perhaps that would have switched the way people were paying attention to the story.
Well, a lot of what he did would have made more sense rather than sending the media spinning into, he's not being like any other candidate. This is completely unprecedented, a word that we heard continuously. Masha offered a persuasive, and she'd say in her words, frame for understanding him, because she said that in Russia, as well as in the Soviet Union, and certainly under Putin, the whole idea is to display your power by saying you don't give a damn if you're caught in a lie. It's your reality to shape. You as the autocrat, that is to say. He has the power to shape our reality, and that is the larger message, not the substance of any of the lies that he actually says, but the bigger message, and that we have to focus on that same message. That's her general thrust on this.
Indira Somani, as a professor of journalism, what sorts of conversations are you having right now with your students about Donald Trump and how the media is covering him?
Well, I can tell you, at least at Howard, the students are very upset. I had emails from students the that night, telling me they were up most of the night crying and very upset. And you know, one even shared with me that she felt that the leader of our country basically hates people that look like her. Howard, as you know, is an HBCU, historically black college and or university, and this was this is also a generation that sees Obama, you know, as with Obama being the president, that's their reality and has been their reality for much of their adult and adolescent life. So students are frustrated. We were all working in the newsroom here with our own coverage until about 2:30 in the morning. Students were staring at the screen when numbers were coming in from the networks, and I think they were just really scared to see that this was the reality. I can't obviously speak for all students, but I'm speaking for the students in the journalism program and the ones in my classes, of course.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to want to talk, as we continue the conversation, a little bit more about how you're talking to them about coverage and what the future of a journalism career looks like right now. We're talking this hour about the future of journalism under President-elect Donald Trump. We're joined by Brooke Gladstone, host of On the Media from WNYC, and Adira Somanias, professor of media, journalism, and film at Howard University. You can join us with your comment or question. How do you think journalists should be attacking this situation, the issue of how we cover Donald Trump as a president and his political actions, the way he uses social media, his comments on Twitter? Give us a call with your comment or question at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. You can also join us online at nprnews.org/live. Now, Donald Trump will be taking office in just under 7 weeks. He has hinted that he won't accommodate a press corps. He's also met with major television news anchors and executives off the record in what was termed as a sort of a beatdown, and the way he talked with and treated them. And then with the New York Times, he spoke on the record. What do those meetings tell us about what access journalists might expect from him, Brooke?
Not much. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. If he doesn't want to accommodate the travel press corps, which has been operating really since the assassination of JFK, then that's obviously a huge departure. He has no interest in getting along with the press because he has his own direct chain of communication in which he can communicate unmediated to the public, leaving the press scraggling behind trying to figure out the hieroglyphics of some of his tweets. Mm-hmm. And how do they measure up to other ones of his tweets? And this gets us back to, and I'm going to start sounding like a one-note Charlie, and I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
But the problem of the way it was covered last time is somehow we thought it made a difference whether or not he said that the wall was going to be a solid wall or the wall was just going to be chicken wire and in the mind, when it was clear that the people who voted for him didn't really care whether he was speaking metaphorically or otherwise. They agreed with the sentiment, and we kept missing the point there. And so when dealing with his tweets or the fact that he can just speak over the heads of the press, we have to keep putting it in the broader context. In terms of his accessibility, which of course was your question, and I really should answer it, there was little access under Bush, even less really under Obama. And this will be smaller still. The media are going to have to work a lot harder on reading documents and relying on leakers and the other things that often lead to much bigger stories than just wandering around with the president like a bird in a gilded cage. So maybe it's not a terrible thing in the long run if he cuts off the Washington Press Corps. The trouble is that will he ever answer a direct question again once he goes into office, or will it simply be the issuance of statements in 140 characters, and that is obviously worrisome.
Yeah. Now, talking about facts and the role that facts do or do not play in our coverage of Trump and trying to track him from one moment to the next, we had Trump surrogate and political commentator Scotty Nell Hughes was on the Diane Rehm show recently, and she had this to say about facts.
One thing that has been interesting this entire campaign season to watch is that people that say facts are facts, they're not really facts. Everybody has a way. It's kind of like looking at ratings or looking at a glass of half full water. Everybody has a way of interpreting them to be the truth or not truth. There's no such thing, unfortunately, more of facts. And so Mr. Trump's tweet amongst a certain crowd, a large part of the population, are truth.
That was we had Scotty Nell Hughes there. That's a clip from her on the Diane Rehm show.
Right. It's terrifying. And let me just say that the significance of that is the ultimate frame that Masha Gessen, the Russian journalist and scholar of autonomies, wants us to pay attention to. You can't countenance, you can't allow a remark like that to stand, that facts don't exist, because that simply leaves the administration, any administration, the opportunity to rewrite our history and rewrite our present reality any way he or she wants to. And that cannot be. That is the number one, the overarching argument that the press needs to be making over and over again, that there is such a thing as reality. It's amazing that we are in a time where that should be the big story. And yet it is. If that notion that, oh, facts don't matter, which is something we've heard a great deal from Trump voters, don't believe PolitiFact, which is a very responsible and balanced fact-checking organization, because they have a liberal bias. And it goes back to Colbert's joke at the Washington dinner that they hold every year, where he said to Bush, we all know that reality has a well-known liberal bias or something, and it seemed, it's lived in infamy. I don't think there was much laughter in the dining hall at the time. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that we have to, as journalists, attack that frame that you are entitled to your own facts. You remember the famous Moynihan story. Everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. That's been quoted endlessly for decades. And now the moment comes where something that seemed like a truism is under attack. And that is our biggest job.
Hmm. Indira Somani, facts are not necessarily facts. How do you talk about that with a journalism student and say, okay, how do you go about doing your job in the face of this, as a former broadcast journalist yourself?
Well, I think the students are frustrated because obviously, President-elect Donald Trump has these statements that he says, and then we don't really know what is truth and what isn't truth. I think the students, what I tell my students at least, is that they're supposed to read as much as they can. And obviously, the more established news organizations that have credibility are ones that I think they can rely on. We obviously, like all journalism programs, we're trying to give them to cover stories and cover stories with both sides to a story, be as objective as possible. But I think they are struggling also to understand what the real truths are in this sort of post-truth election reality. Students,
just a second. When you say cover both sides of the story, but when you have one side of the story that seems to be using lies and propaganda, how do you cover that story?
Well, I think what's happening with our students is they are reading a variety of news sources also to see what others are saying, to see what other other news organizations are saying. I think it is frustrating when you have, it is frustrating when President-elect Trump is saying one thing and he means another. It is difficult for them to understand exactly what is fact and what is fiction. I think one thing they can do is, yes, they are simply regurgitating sound bites here based on what the president said. But I think that also means that the president is being held accountable, just like with Carrier. He said he never, you know, promised to keep their jobs, and then the tape was replayed, and sure enough, he said something to the effect that Carrier's jobs should not be going overseas, and he tried to, backpedal on that. So, that's something in itself, is just being able to cover exactly what President-elect Trump is saying, and being able to use that as a way of reporting or reminding him exactly what he did say.
We're talking this hour about the future of journalism under President-elect Trump, and we're talking with Indira Somani, assistant professor of media, journalism, and film at Howard University, as well as Brooke Gladstone, host of On the Media. I'd like to go to the phones. We've got a lot of people in line with questions for us, so let's go to the phones. We've got Jim in Andover. Jim, welcome to NPR. What's your comment or question?
Yeah, first of all, I appreciate you guys as professionalism in general. However, I feel that, especially in this election, we've pretty much lost faith in the media to give us the whole story. They keep taking things out of context and especially with somebody like Donald Trump, who's frequently talking of opinion instead of necessarily the exact fact. You guys keep trying to turn it into an exact fact. One example is you keep using the word Donald Trump hates immigrants. Donald Trump hates black people. In reality, he said illegal aliens, and over CBS, NBC, NPR, you guys keep using the word he hates immigrants, and stuff like that is just ridiculous. And so we lose faith in your reporting because we know that you guys are biased. Didn't like him. You still continue to hate Donald Trump, and you guys continue to divide our nation.
All right, Jim, thanks for your call. Brooke Gladstone, thoughts on how
sure.
to respond?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, the response is in the caller's comment himself. He will constantly say one thing and then another thing and then another thing. If you look at his comments in totality, what you'll see in his policies and in his suggestions and in his proposals, as well as his ever varying in opinion, the general thrust is an anti-immigrant proposal. Even people who have citizenship, he said at one time, might be at risk. I mean, you can pick through, as you can through the Bible or the Constitution, and find whatever it is that accords to your preferred view of Donald Trump. What the media have tried to do is express the general thrust of his remarks in a short way. I mean, everything that's hyper simplified anything that's shortened is going to be really simplified. But the fact is, if you take all of his remarks and his shifting positions as a whole, you get the story that you've heard from the New York Times and NPR and so forth. That is the Donald Trump. One thing that Masha Gessen has said all the time is believe the autocrat. That is the first rule here. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, a big Donald Trump frame is you can't believe the media. And that's a comfortable one if you want to believe Donald Trump. I mean, basically, we're wired to believe what we want to believe. And the press is as guilty of that as the electorate. I'm certainly not saying we're setting ourselves above it, but we're very conscious of it, and we're trying.
You know, the day after the election, you and your co-host Bob Garfield and your producer sat down for a chat that ended up becoming a podcast called What Now, to sort of reacting to the news and figuring out, okay, how do we move forward? And one of the things you said was about we need to make what was invisible to us.
Yeah,
the invisible visible. Tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that.
What I mean is that we all of us increasingly live in bubbles, both geographically and certainly with regard to the consumption of media. It is very easy for any American to go through their lives and never hear a fact or even an idea that runs counter to their own view of the world. And that is a very, very comfortable and seductive thing. And we, like I mentioned the wiring earlier, we are all susceptible to that. We have to bring people on the show that we generally talk about but not to, and bring our questions directly to them. We've always tried to do that. But I think that given that there was so much of the story that was right in front of our faces that we missed, we need to try even harder. Bob and I got into an argument about it. People on Twitter, quite a few said, I hate to see mom and dad fight. But as Katya observed, actually, that's just Monday. On the media. but it was a very naked and raw conversation, and you could hear the sort of recalibration and pushing in one direction or another that that we have to cope with if we're going to do our job as thoughtfully and effectively as we're obliged to, given that we have the microphone. It's mm-hmm. a huge responsibility.
It is. With that in mind, I'd like to go back to the phones. We've got Jane on the line in St. Paul. Jane, welcome to the conversation. What's your comment?
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I thought that the duty of the media, to begin with, was to afflict the comfortable and to comfort the afflicted. And that's what I've been taught since I was a child. But I've seen this through the years become a society in which the media is referred to only as journalists rather than the simple reporters that they used to be referred to actually respectfully. And we've become a society, unfortunately, that I've seen with this last election, I think most of us have, where you could have that first gentleman who was your first caller to say, you want to hold him to the exact facts. I thought that's what facts were. They are to be exact. He has not been a person who we can say goes beyond what Toni Morrison called when she said, pay attention to him, because she said, if a man tells you who he is, respect that and believe him the first time. So you're talking about the next 4 years, which are going to be very, very difficult, is you are going to have to act as the individual who tells us what the facts really are that we've already been told and will be told different versions of it, just as we were throughout the entire campaign. It is a very sad time for America, but it's also a time that reporters can shine. I really do believe that some of the media now will have to show its mettle and stand up to this gentleman if we're to keep a democracy and not turn into what his cabinet is showing us, an oligarchy.
All right. Jane, thank you so much for your call. Brooke, you mentioned earlier that with this lack of access to the president, that reporters are going to have to do more digging, more reading of papers, and relying more on leakers. Isn't that old school journalism at its best? Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing?
Well, yeah.
I hope so.
Izzy Stone used to never go to a press conference and almost had no sources, a famous investigative reporter in the latter half of the 20th century. And he would read to the bottoms of documents. It tells you a lot. I mean, even the New York Times, after their famous meeting with Trump, said he seemed to have changed his mind on torture after meeting with General Mattis. And then and they were working from their own transcript, which was very good. But then the transcript, if you read to the bottom, as I know this because my husband, Fred Kaplan, works at Slate, and he actually did. He read to the bottom, and it said, when he said, I have changed my mind, that's a mistake in the transcript. Correction, I have not changed my mind. And so it's important to read all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, this is something we've gotten out of the practice of, and it's something that we have to do. I expect that, or I hope that there'll be people who will speak to the press, even if they're not supposed to. I know that the president-elect is famous for making people sign non-disclosure agreements. So, and then there is the government. But look, this is going to be a time, and if I quote Masha again, she said it's an opportunity, as the caller just said, for a renewal of the true spirit of the press. And in terms of afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted, she alluded to the fact that what used to be a fairly low-class job, reporter, has become professionalized, and we're now all journalists. And I think that that also has led to the profession growing increasingly out of touch with so many Americans. So all of that is true. I agreed with everything the previous caller just said. And I'll just stop there because I could just blather on first.
Indira Somani, it sounded like you wanted to chime in there. Do you see this as a time for renewal and sort of the core values of journalism, how it's done?
Yeah, I actually do. I think that we have introduced a course here called Truth Be Told. And basically, it's a course. It's actually a one-credit course where students are helping to uncover the inaccuracies of African Americans. For example, it is a myth that African Americans, you know, love fried chicken. Where did that myth start from? These are the kinds of truths that this class is heavily involved in, and you know, other myths like that. And I just want to say that I think that students are inundated with tons of information, more information, of course, than I was inundated with when I was in journalism school. And so they are also struggling sometimes exactly, you know, what to believe, what not to believe, especially in this age of social media. I think students, at least, you know, here at Howard, I think many students have felt a little uneasy about what they see sometimes in mainstream media. They see biases, they see irregularities, and I think students are definitely getting into the habit of reading more, and especially, you know, reading different types of sources, especially, you know, smaller, you know, smaller sources, maybe not as well-known sources, but getting a chance to read and hear from, you know, like one of our own Howard alums, Ta-Nehisi Coates. I mean, he's come to campus several times. We've had several post-election kind of forums on campus where the president, the alums, many renowned faculty here have had open forums to talk to the students to help them feel comforted, help them feel assured that that they will be able to continue in this Trump world. And I mean, some are actually genuinely concerned about their own safety. We have a large international population here, and students from Nepal that are our number one group of students from other countries. Of course, we have a number of students from all over Africa here.
Right.
So it's definitely on the mind.
I hate to interrupt you there, but I do want to get us to our callers, and we're going to get to some of our callers real soon. If you would like to join the conversation, you can reach us at 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Let's get right back to the phones. We've got Sean on the line in Minneapolis. Sean, welcome to NPR.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. What's your question or comment?
Well, so I'm the organizer of the U.S. Presidential Science Debates, and I actually dedicate a couple of chapters to this problem in my book, The War on Science. There has been an erosion in the media of the idea of objectivity over the last 20 to 30 years. Journalism schools teach actively that there is no such thing as objectivity. And the Society of Professional Journalists removed the objectivity ethical requirement from their code of ethics in the 1990s. And the problem is that when journalists then come to believe that there's no such thing as objectivity, they instead rely on the idea of balance. And this enables vested interests and public relations experts who often come out of the media to manipulate them by simply pointing out that, well, there are always two sides to every story. So this idea of balance is a structural problem in the media itself that we really, journalists really need to grapple with. The entire purpose of journalism in a free society is to hold the powerful accountable to the evidence, which is something that I think we've lost sight of.
Thanks for that comment, Sean. Brooke Gladstone, I remember many years ago you paid a visit to the NPR newsroom and we talked about this very thing. I believe you said something along the lines of it's impossible for a reporter to be completely unbiased, and something along the lines of you believe the best solution is to be transparent about your bias. Does that, am I remembering that
well,
correctly?
Well, that is part of it. That was, it was probably 2011 after I emptied my brain into the comic book, The Influencing Machine, in which I describe the evolution of the behavior of the press. And in any case, I agree with everything that the caller just said. Once again, I do have a quibble with the idea of objectivity. I think as somebody who's protecting, whose job is to uphold and make sure science isn't murdered, we know that human beings are not capable of real objectivity. They are capable of balance. The trouble is the balance is frequently false. If you give, you know, equal amount of space to two ideas, and one of which is entirely worthy and demonstrable and backed up by facts, which, by the way, do exist, and another one that has absolutely no or virtually no support in the world of science. You know, this is what's caused so much smoke cast over the idea, especially recently, of global warming. If facts cease to exist, if Trump tweets that it's a plan concocted by the Chinese and then says he didn't say it and then says he did say it, and then people have caught the have captured the tweet and so can show he said it and so on. And then you want to give two equal sides. You're not serving the public. As he said, you are not conveying the best, the most accurate version of reality as you can. And that is the number one job of the journalist, is not to mislead the public, even if it protects you as an institution. And of course, the journalists have always been running for cover, really, at least since the Nixon administration, to the idea that it has a left-wing bias. So it will bend over backwards and do something that I call false balance, which is a huge problem endemic in the media, which he has referred to. I think that you can be fair. I think you can be transparent, but you have to contextualize. If you have an entire consensus of the scientific community that says global warming exists and it's related to man-made behavior, and then you have one person who is a scientist paid for by ExxonMobil who says something else. Mm-hmm. If you want to put that voice in there, then you have to talk about who pays his salary. And go ahead and talk about who pays the other scientists' salaries to the various universities if you have space in your column to do so or in your story to do so. But if you're going to put that in, then you've got to say this is one person out of 2,000 or 20,000 or 100,000 that feels this way. And we've done a terrible job doing that because we think if we do it, people will think we're lefty.
Now, most of journalism is a for-profit business. And even we here in the nonprofit sector like to see high page views, lots of engagement on social media. In an age where things are rated often more for being shareworthy rather than being newsworthy, you have to admit Trump's statements and actions are a clickbait goldmine. Can journalists and their bosses resist the temptation of following him in that sort of way of saying, oh, look at his last tweet, look at this, look at that, when, and many people are saying the attention is the problem?
Yeah, a lot of them won't resist. I think many of us will. I think that people, the problem with a lot of these discussions, and of course I spent the last God knows how many years criticizing my colleagues in the media. So I'm perfectly willing to sit here and do that. But I think we have entered a period where so much more of the responsibility falls on the news consumer to confront their own biases and to create a broader sphere of news consumption, to pay for the news organizations that matter to them, to subscribe to their local paper before it goes away, because otherwise you'll have no state house coverage, to stop thinking that information should be free in the sense of not paid for. It's never been the case, and it never will be the case. You will pay one way or the other. It's because of the fact that the business has had its financial crap kicked out of it, that it subscribes to behavior that it's been worse than it has been. Many reporters have been let off. There is a desperate need to show advertisers online that people are going to see their ad, all of that stuff. You want quality journalism, you start subscribing. I mean, when I was a kid, we didn't pay for TV. We didn't pay for water. Now we buy bottles of water and we pay for TV. We can learn this behavior, but it's pretty incumbent on news consumers to vary their media diet and to pay for the quality stuff that doesn't succumb to cheap clickbait techniques in order to maintain their bottom line.
I'm misquoting, but there's something along the lines of the, you know, for a healthy electorate or informed democracy, you need an informed electorate. For a healthy democracy, you need an informed electorate. And the problem is when you have so many fake news sites to choose from that will confirm whatever your personal biases are amidst all of this other journalism, how do you find, you know, we're counting on the electorate to find the right sites and to pay for them when they could get so much else for free that's much more comforting to them.
That's right. And really what it boils down to in the end is, do we trust our fellow Americans or our fellow human beings to act in the best interest of both themselves and the country? And will they make a personal commitment to do that? Or won't they? Won't we? And you know, fundamentally, that's what it comes down to. It is the news consumer's job to make sure they're not consuming a huge amount of junk food that makes them feel good in the moment. And it's pretty easy to see what news sites are fake if you're looking at it. We offer a guide at onthemedia.org, one of our breaking news consumers guide on how to identify fake news. It's really not that hard. There are plenty of news sources that essentially don't exist, but they have names and they offer junk. Something like Occupy Democrats, the Angry Patriot, U.S. Chronicle, ChristianTimes.com.co. You know, anything that has .co or .com.co is generally a nonsense site, and they'll often borrow for the front of their URL, something like msnbc.com.co or abcnews.com.co. If you see a .co, if you see a site that uses all caps a lot, if you read a story that makes you furious, then it's written to make you furious. We have Google. We can follow these things up. If we try and keep an open mind, we can get to the truth.
Dylan in Minneapolis asks, how will journalists push against the normalization of racism and hatred? How do you do that and seem balanced when it counters what the president is saying from his position? Indira, do you want it? Is
sure.
that something you're dealing with at Howard?
So I just want to read this quote to you from one of my students that was sent to me at 8:41 on Wednesday, November 9th, the morning after. She basically says, most of us in the School of Communications were in the School of Communications until very late last night covering the election and have been traumatized. I have not slept, and I have spent most of the night crying, not only out of fear, but just the realization that this country still genuinely hates me and people who look like me. I think that, first of all, I agreed with the last two callers, and I really appreciate everything, you know, Brooke is saying. I think the students are definitely savvy about being able to see what are fake news sites and what are not fake news sites. That I can appreciate, the fact that they perhaps are not gullible, so to speak, and can definitely see the difference between when something is spreading rumor and something is actually trying to enforce a healthy democracy. I definitely think that this is something that this particular generation has to be savvy about going forward. It's really being able to decipher what are facts being facts, for lack of a better term. What is information that?
I'm sorry, we have just a minute left, so I just want to cut to the chase here and ask both of you: what are the sites you trust most? Maybe give us our top one or two places you go to for trusted news, Brooke.
Well, I think the New York Times does a great job. I also I'm probably because I was reading Slate before my husband even worked there. I think it's gotten very broad, very big, and it's fast reactive. You have to be careful. Anything that's produced within hours of an event may have some issues, but I find that site is pretty well edited. I think the Washington Post has really had a resurgence in basically since money bags took over there and some, we'll see how it goes, but at least so far it's been pretty good.
And there have been, and Indira?
Oh, you know, actually, I wanted to say the Post and the Times.
Okay.
I totally agree with Brooke. I also am fond of NPR site.
Oh, well, thank you. We'll let you get that one in. Thanks so much, you both. I'm afraid we're out of time, but really appreciate the conversation. Obviously, lots more we could talk about. Thanks also to all the callers who are in line. Sorry to those of you we didn't get to. We've been talking about the future of journalism with Brooke Gladstone, host of On the Media from WNYC, and Indira Somani, who's professor of media, journalism, and film at Howard University. This is NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs.